From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. You see a gorilla in the wild, and you can't help think of this as some version of ourselves, laughing, tumbling, calling out. But the wars and ways of Africa and our own demand for minerals have been hell on gorillas. Mountain gorillas almost blinked out. Now, the great Growers gorilla, world's largest primate, is facing a population crisis. Between human hunger for bushmeat and the minerals in your cell phone, they are in dire trouble. This hour on Point, the gorillas fight for survival. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you followed the story of our cousins, the world's largest primate, as militias and miners go deep into their territory and hunt them for food? What do you feel about gorillas possibly becoming extinct in your lifetime? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Let's listen just for a second here to the sound of a group of orphaned. These are growers and mountain gorillas, and we'll talk about the distinction in just a moment here. This is orphaned gorillas humming in delight as they munch on a favorite food, banana tree stalks. Their parents were killed by poachers, and in this video they're being housed and protected by a group called Gorilla Doctors in Kinigi, Rwanda. You want to find out what's going on with these populations? You had better prepare for some rough stuff. Here's a scene from a video released last month by the Wildlife Conservation Society about its survey of growers gorillas. We're going to hear a lot more about that in a moment. Almost 80% decline in population in not very many years. Congolese and foreign researchers, field assistants, park rangers walked more than 12,000 kilometers through the jungle for this survey to let us know about these numbers and what's going on. Along the way, they occasionally encountered poachers, illegal miners. Here, one encounter turned violent.
10 of the park rangers move through the thick forest to arrest the miners. The miners, however, called in members of the local armed militia, leading to an armed confrontation. The ensuing gunfight lasted over 40 minutes. When the bullets stopped flying, park rangers had managed to drive off the militia and arrest 5 of the miners. But the assault was not yet over.
The science, the survey you're going to hear about today comes at a great price in a human life, in bravery. The miners who escaped right there came back. Militia reinforcements came back, I should say, chased the rangers and researchers deep into the forest overnight. This is serious business. It's not only gorillas in trouble. Later in this hour, we're going to talk with the great Richard Leakey in Nairobi, Kenya, about the dizzying pressure now on elephants after last week's huge burn-off of 100 tons of contraband ivory tusks in Kenya. But first, to the Growers gorilla and their story. Joining me from Liverpool, England, is Stuart Nixon. His day job now is field program coordinator at England's Chester Zoo. He spent nearly 10 years living in the Congo, much of it camped out in eastern Congo's rainforests, where he marched more than 1,000 miles surveying the Growers gorilla range and population. He's co-author of a big new study based on those surveys funded by the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fauna and Flora International. Stuart Nixon in Liverpool, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Would you be kind enough to introduce us to the Growers gorilla, what it is, how it's different from the mountain gorilla that we perhaps know better?
Yes, of course. Well, Growers gorilla is the biggest primate, as you've already pointed out.
Can go over 400 pounds, it can go.
Yeah, 400, 450, maybe even approaching 500 in very, very big males. Yeah. It's a species of eastern gorilla. There's actually two species of gorillas, western gorillas and eastern gorillas. And the eastern gorilla has the very famous mountain gorilla, which was made famous by Diane Fossey. Mm-hmm. And slightly to the west, there is another larger population of gorillas called the Growers gorilla. Mm-hmm. It's formerly been called an eastern lowland gorilla. Before that, right back to the 60s, they were actually all classed as mountain gorillas in eastern Congo. But there are some physical differences and differences in their ecology and the behavior in the forest, which make them quite unique. So, they're fantastic, huge ape, biggest ape in the world.
A subspecies then of in the gorilla family?
Absolutely, a subspecies, yeah. And restricted entirely to eastern Congo. You only find them in eastern Congo over an area that's about the size of Connecticut.
Now, we think of, if you look on a map, the greatest concentration of the gorillas that we pay attention to, I guess, is here at the sort of intersection of Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, Virunga, the national park there with its misty mountains that we've all come to know. Very beautiful. That's the mountain gorilla redoubt. Their numbers got so low in the 1980s. I'm reading here down to 250, now back maybe to 1,000. The Grauer's gorilla, what they can go into the mountains, but they also go into flatter land that's west of there and not quite so hard to reach, I suppose.
Well, I would say this is part of the reason that we actually call them Grauer's gorilla rather than an eastern lowland gorilla.
Okay.
And the name comes from the man who first collected them in the wild, Rudolf Grauer. That was in 1908, I think. And actually, to the west of where the mountain gorillas live, mm-hmm. the forest is a lower altitude, but it's still very, very mountainous. So you actually find the Grauer's gorilla living in these mountainous, lower altitude forests. It's really because that we do find them in mountains that we tend not to call them a lowland gorilla.
There's been so much trouble in this region. The tremendous spillover from the Rwandan genocide in the mid-90s. Refugees and militias just swarming over this area. And then all kinds of political trouble, civil war in Congo. Can you just remind us what the last estimate of the Grauer's population was and what you found in your survey? It's being called a catastrophic collapse of the world's largest great ape. What is the diminution of numbers that you've found?
Okay, so the very first estimates were done way back by New York Zoological Society, which became the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Mm-hmm.
And they, by the eminent zoologist George Shell, and he estimated there were maybe 5,000 of these gorillas left in eastern Congo. Then in the 1990s, an American researcher, again for Wildlife Conservation Society, Jefferson Hall, did extensive surveys in eastern Congo and found that there was likely then to have been around 17,000 of the gorillas. So the numbers hadn't necessarily gone up. It was just a much
better
more
survey.
Better survey. So since 2000, I first went to eastern Congo in 2000 with the intention of picking up on these surveys, and started some surveys 2004, and then we got together with the Wildlife Conservation Society. And in 2012, we started these coordinated, a much bigger survey project together. And what we found from that is that the numbers have actually plummeted right down. They're now down to 3,800, which is nearly 80% decline. We've expected a decline, but it's much worse than what we'd anticipated. So it's a real blow.
You're hoping that they will be designated as a critically endangered gorilla. What has driven such a dramatic decline in Grauer's gorilla numbers in these years?
Primarily, it's hunting. It's hunting for bushmeat. Gorillas have always been hunted for bushmeat for as long as there's been a dynamic between human populations and gorillas. They've been hunted. But what's really caused it, the conflict in eastern Congo has made it very lawless, and that has increased the amount of illegal artisanal mining, so hand mining, basically digging of important minerals, specifically coltan, which is in our mobile phones. And what the miners have done when they've gone into the forest, obviously they need to eat. There's not many alternatives there to find a protein source, so they just basically hunt everything out from around the mines. And really that has been the major impact on the gorillas, is forests being overrun with militias and mines and eaten. Basically, they've been eaten.
So to find the coltan, the Colombo tantalite, or coltan for mobile phones and laptop computers and digital cameras, they go in, artisanal mines, you say. These aren't huge operations. These are little, they're digging small scale. But these beautiful primates become their food source, their bush meat. I mean, It seems when you look at them and feel our cousinship with them, it sounds almost cannibalistic. Sounds gross.
Yeah, I guess that's a very, very much the Western aesthetic that we have, okay. I think, for many, for Central African cultures,
food.
Of them. It's food. The Swahili word for animal is the same as meat, nyama. It's exactly the same word. So it's really a necessity. People need to eat, and if they run into a gorilla group, they'll shoot them and they'll eat them.
Is there no protection for them there?
There are national parks which it's illegal to hunt, it's illegal to mine, it's illegal really for civil society to enter the parks. But with the war, the protection has broken down, and actually very often the greatest concentration of the mineral resources is actually been in the national parks themselves. It could be that the national parks were actually set up in the 70s partly to protect the resources which were within them, rather than the gorillas.
And I'm reading here that somewhere between 170 to 200 park rangers have been killed in Eastern Congo since 1996. So that would be a pretty dangerous job.
Very dangerous job. Yeah, they're very, very brave, dedicated rangers who are working out there under very difficult conditions, often with very little pay or little financial government support.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gorillas, the world's largest primates, Grauer's gorillas, going down, facing extinction in the face of encroachment, turmoil, human pressure. Gorillas that will be missed, that already are. My guest is Stuart Nixon. He is one of the authors of a new study from the Wildlife Conservation Society and Fauna and Flora International, looking at Grauer's gorillas in eastern Congo, a catastrophic collapse of that population under the weight of small-scale miners eating bushmeat, militias roaming this area in the wake of the Rwandan genocide and civil war in Congo. The number's down to just, fewer than 4,000 now, down from 17,000 not so many years ago. It's hard to imagine. It's hard to consider. You can join us this hour. How do you feel seeing the last of the greatest wild primates brought to the edge of extinction in your lifetime? And will war and human hunger and the minerals in your cell phone mean the end of the great gorillas? Can you stomach the idea of these awesome creatures going down as bushmeat dinners for jungle fighters and miners, going down as barbecue? Here's a little video from the Bwindi National Park in Uganda. This is not far from this area, where a group of gorillas wander into a camp of eco-tourists. One tourist, John, crouches submissively. There's a huge male silverback, some babies, a couple of females gather around him. Pretty soon the babies are playing with John's hair, and a female kisses him. You hear the man filming, probably the guide, describing to John what's happening behind him, and John, with these gorillas all over him, responding in a whisper.
Oh, no way, John. No way. Tell me what you're feeling now, John. The silverback is just behind you. He sat a meter behind you, and there are three babies squashed between him and you.
The silverback right behind John there. And here's a moment from some documentary footage shot for CBS of a family of Grauer's gorillas hanging out in a rainforest in Congo. Stuart Nixon spent many years in Congo tracking down these latest numbers. How did you do it, Stuart? How did you figure out what the numbers are? I can't imagine how you begin to accomplish that.
Well, it really comes down to getting out onto the ground, getting your boots on and getting out into the forest themselves. Very often, very remote places, some of them unexplored scientifically before these surveys. We take teams in, researchers and observers, a lot of very well-trained local Congolese guys and Congolese scientists as well, and we basically walk into the forest. Sometimes we can walk up to almost 100 miles into the forest, and then we set up a camp, and we head out from there, and we basically walk very straight lines in the forest. And any gorilla nest...
Looking for what? For the animals themselves, or...?
If we're lucky, normally we it's indirect signs. Every night, every gorilla makes a nest out of branches and leaves and a nice springy nest.
A new nest every night?
A new nest every night, yes.
Wow, okay.
And you can tell from the number of nests generally how many gorillas are in that group. So what we do is we walk through the forest and we're looking for nest sites, and we count the number of nests, and then we do... You know, we do the science, and that basically comes up with an estimate for a population estimate for that area.
Wow. And so you're able to do that's a lot of walking in a lot of straight lines through a lot of very remote jungle and terrain.
Yeah, the straight lines, fortunately, are usually quite small. We do short straight lines, but spaced out. So then we kind of have to walk between them.
Make a grid so you can scientifically make an estimate of what's there. Lots of response from people online here. Sam says, you know, the world's in trouble when we push our cousins to extinction. Another, Sam Adams, says, very sad that humans are destroying everything of real value. Stuart Nixon spent years and years in the Democratic Republic of Congo doing this counting. I mean, I remember, Stuart, flying in not long after the Rwandan genocide, flying into Kigali, and on the plane from Europe, I think it was the first team of guerrilla researchers going to see the damage that had been done in the immediate aftermath, when there were so many refugees fleeing that and so much fighting going on. But, of course, it didn't stop in the aftermath of the genocide. The impact of the refugees and the militias that grew up around them, the civil war in Congo, as remote as these areas may be, they are not at all immune to human politics.
Not at all, no. I think very much so once you get into what we'd call the interior, the deep forests where we find Graue's gorilla, it's really militia run, most of that region. Different militias fighting over segments of forest which hold the mineral resources within them. So, and still ongoing. I mean, I think officially we would say that the war in Congo is finished, the civil war, but there's still a great deal of insecurity and fighting on a local scale, but very widespread across the whole range of the gorillas.
Stuart, please stand by there in Liverpool. With us right now from Oakland, California's Holly Dranguinis, senior policy analyst at the Enough Project. It's a Washington-based nonprofit, studies the impact of economics and war on the environment, focusing mostly on Congo, Sudan, Central African Republic. Holly's an expert on conflict minerals and issues of wildlife poaching and trafficking. She'll soon release a new report from the Enough Project on the Virunga region. She was in Congo just last July. Holly Dranguinis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You talk about charcoal as well, another kind of mind-blowingly elementary thing that is tied up with this. But take us to the minerals first and these artisanal miners that Stuart's talking about. They go into this region and they get in there. They're looking for what may go into our cell phones and they need to eat. And horrifically, at least to my eye, the largest of all primates becomes their dinner.
That's right. One of the tragedies that faces the Democratic Republic of Congo, especially in the east, is this tremendous natural resource wealth. This is the deadliest war since World War II, with at least 5.4 million people dead from war-related causes. And especially in recent years, the war has been financed by militias who are mining illegally, who are fishing illegally, who essentially take control over anything of value in order to finance their activities. And minerals, of course, the four conflict minerals, tin, tantalum, tungsten, and gold, which are found in everyday consumer products like cell phones, laptops, video games, fine
consoles,
jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
These are incredibly lucrative materials for armed groups to trade. And they mine the minerals in, as Stuart mentioned, oftentimes within these national parks that are supposed to be protected, and then smuggle them out. And the minerals do make their way into the international market and into our everyday products.
And people are eating gorillas in order to do that mining in the boondocks there. I've read about kind of a move to have a stamp that would go on your cell phone that would call it bushmeat free or conservation friendly, a kind of validation. Is that going on? Is there a way to check whether the minerals in a particular product, you know, may have been mined with less dire impact than this?
Well, this is the good news. There is a lot of innovative thinking happening around how to distinguish minerals that are maybe linked to conflict in mm-hmm. eastern Congo and maybe even linked to poaching of gorillas, and distinguishing that from conflict-free minerals. And there are amazing efforts happening both internationally and in the region locally to set up better transparency mechanisms. And in the U.S., the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act includes a provision that requires companies to publicly report about what they're doing to find out whether their minerals are connected to conflict or not in Congo. And we've seen that that has had some positive impact already on the armed groups in the region.
We got calls for the two of you. Rita in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Rita, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to make a comment, and that is that I personally believe that it would be very difficult to guarantee the source of a mineral.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be extremely difficult. And you know, one has to remember that these armed groups are supplied with arms from different countries, that being United States, Russia, China. You know, these are the countries that supply arms. And, you know, these are the countries that need to step up and, you know, put something into place where these armed groups do not get these weapons. And the other fact is that historically there have been governments, superpowers, United States, Russia, China, what have you, and they support these politicians and dictators that, you know, run these countries. It's a fact.
Well,
I think that
true enough, but also local economic interests. I mean, some of these interests become so local. Holly writes about or talks about just charcoal. They go into these old growth forests and turn them into charcoal, and in the process also run into the gorillas and kill or eat them. I mean, not everything is a global scale. Even arms, there are so many arms in Africa now, Rita. I mean, I take your point, but can you imagine how long you'd have to squeeze the arms out of Africa? We can't squeeze them out of Connecticut.
This is true, and there are alternatives. It's just that the countries that have the wherewithal have to do something in these countries that are very poor. You know, there are many different programs, such as I believe there's a program where they give solar ovens to people in places in Africa, you know, and this cuts down on people
on deforestation.
It cuts down or eliminates deforestation.
I like the way you're thinking. Think granular with solar ovens. Think big with big powers, seeing what they can do something about it. Forgive me, Rita. I'm glad for your call from the Virgin Islands. We've got just a few minutes more with my guests here. We're looking at the Grauer's gorilla facing a catastrophic population collapse in the Congo. Let me get one more caller right here from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks to you and your guests for tackling this issue. Mm-hmm. I'm involved in it with the grizzly bears from, you know, remote regions in Alaska through Montana.
Good.
And game management units. And my thing is about preservation. Has the guest private ownership, vitalground.org out in Missoula, Montana, buys and acquires and gets deeded properties so bears don't have to hopscotch and it's they protect the genetic pool, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask your guests about private ownership in the area or drone technology to police grids where people that would come in to kill these gorillas could be detected and dealt with.
Holly, what about it? Could you have a philanthropist buying up a vast tract there and somehow seal it off? And what about drones monitoring these grids? People are really looking for answers here. What comes to mind for you, Holly?
So many investors have actually stepped up to support the better protection of space that is already legally protected, like Virunga National Park. Some wonderful foundations like the 11th Hour Project here in the Bay Area and the Howard Buffett Foundation are supporting efforts to professionalize the ranger forces in Virunga National Park, to develop alternative fuels, sustainable, eco-friendly alternative fuels to break the dependence that communities have on the charcoal that's made from the old-growth forest in the parks. Drone technology, I'm glad you brought that up. It's obviously a cutting-edge and very promising tool that is being used to survey areas to better understand both the wildlife populations and the changes that are happening there and the movement of the animals, but also better understand these criminal networks, how they operate, when they're poaching animals, how they're trading with one another. And that drone surveillance has been very useful. The UN has provided drones and more is needed. So that kind of intelligence is critical.
Donna in Syracuse, New York. Donna, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. First time caller, long time listener.
Wonderful to have you.
Question.
Yeah.
What can the average person who doesn't have much money, what can they do to help? Is there organizations over here in the U.S. that we can join to help further the protection?
We'll pick it right up, Donna. Stuart, what would you say to that first from Liverpool?
I think there are a number of things which the public at large can do to help gorilla conservation. I think firstly, there are organisations American-based. There's the Wildlife Conservation Society. There is Fauna and Flora International US. There's Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund International. There's a number of organisations engaged with gorilla conservation. I think on a more personal level, I think we should, really try to... the buyer needs to put, pressure on the manufacturer to make sure that we're buying that minerals are sourced correctly, recycling mobile phones. These kind of things can all help reduce the impact on the Congo, as it were. I think just being aware as well and kind of spreading the word, talking to people about these issues, and the more people that know about it, hopefully more people will be inspired to take some kind of action.
How much time do we have, Stuart? Down 20 years and the population from 17,000 plus down to 3,000 plus. That's a giant tumble. How much time do we have?
Not very much. I mean, we could be looking at more local extinctions in the next couple of years. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time in these forests. Personally, my teams have discovered small gorilla populations as recently as 2005. By 2013, they'd gone. So, the next 10 years maybe, we'll be right down to tiny fragmented populations.
Holly, give us an action plan, Holly. We've just got half a minute here, but tell us more. What can people do? What should be done?
Yeah, ask the companies that you're buying your cell phones from, what are they doing to ensure that the minerals in their products are conflict-free. You can also support some really important legislation that's moving through Congress right now. In particular, the Anti-Global Poaching Act will help support legal action that will break the impunity surrounding deforestation and poaching in the region. It will help support the professionalization of rangers so that rangers can better protect the forests and animals.
Find the legislation.
And supporting these charities as well is something that can be done.
We're out of time right there. More on elephants in a moment. Holly Draganis with the Enough Project in Oakland, California. Thank you so much, Holly.
Thank you, Tom.
Stuart Nixon with Wildlife Conservation Society, Fauna and Flora International. Thank you for your work, Stuart.
No problem. Thank you very much, Tom.
We'll be back in one moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last Saturday, more than 100 tons of elephant tusks, stacked in huge pyres worth more than $100 million on the black market, were set aflame under orders of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. It was the biggest burn in history. The message to poachers, smugglers, and their customers that ivory is worthless unless it is on a living elephant. So many are being killed. We're going to talk in just a moment with Dr. Richard Leakey, famed Kenyan paleoanthropologist, conservationist, politician, chairman of Kenya Wildlife Services. But I wonder if you saw or heard this. It took Kenya's Wildlife Services Department 10 days to build the pyres out of 105 tons of tusks from around 8,000 elephants, along with rhino horn and exotic animal skins, all added up to maybe more than $170 million worth in the black market. And last Saturday, it was all set ablaze. Here's a CNN report showing park workers lugging huge tusks on their shoulders and stacking them on 10-foot-high, 20-foot-wide pyres.
A heavy burden for Kenyans to bear. Never has the continent's poaching epidemic been so visceral than this endless train of elephant tusks. And soon this will turn into a crematorium. 12 pyres of ivory and rhino horn will be set ablaze in the largest burn of illegal wildlife products in history.
Are you watching this? This terrible onslaught against elephants and Kenyans trying to do something about it, burning those tusks to discourage more killing. 8,000 elephants maybe died for those tusks. The man who organized the first ivory burn in 1989 and stood watching this last burn ceremony last weekend is the famed Kenyan paleoanthropologist, conservationist, politician Richard Leakey. He is chairman of Kenya Wildlife Services, co-founder of the Turkana Basin Institute, author of The Sixth Extinction, Patterns of Life and the Future of Humankind. He joins us right now from Nairobi. Dr. Leakey, we are very grateful to have you with us today.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Can you remind us of the logic of ivory burns, like this enormous ivory burn just a few days ago? Why?
Well, it was a very depressing spectacle, but unfortunately, over the last 30 years, the market for ivory ornaments, trinkets, and carvings has grown up in China and in other countries. And unless we can kill the market, we're not going to stop the poaching. And I would rather kill the market than kill the poacher. With 105 tons ablaze, I can tell you it was surreal. I think everyone in the world practically will have heard or will soon hear of this event. And many people are saying, why did you do it? We're doing it because unless people stop buying ivory for ornamentation, for pride, there will be no elephants in 40 or 50 years. Now, people say, well, if you burn a commodity, you're going to increase its value. Unfortunately, they're wrong. If you burn ivory, which is used for show-off, people want an ivory chopstick,
yep,
something made of shiny ivory on the mantel shelf, fine. But if you now can get the international community to say, shame on you, how disgusting that you're wearing bits of a dead elephant who's poached illegally in Africa, then I think we can kill the market. And that killing can be done both in Europe, North America, as well as in China. I'm convinced of that.
Where did all these tusks come from, Dr. Leakey?
Most of the tusks that we burn have been confiscated in raids on poaching hideouts, transshipments from other African countries coming through Kenya. It represents less than 5% of the illegal ivory that's now sitting in various people's storehouses. And what I would like to see is that we never again allow the international trade in elephant ivory. We had that ban in 1979. It did an extremely useful job in keeping the price of ivory down. The ban was partially lifted for South Africa and some other Southern African countries. Immediately the price rose, and we've got to kill the trade. We must kill the trade now.
How desperate is the situation when it comes to elephant numbers and the onslaught of hunting for tusks?
Well, it varies from country to country. I think in Kenya, we're in pretty good shape now. The Kenya Wildlife Service has done an excellent job over the last year. But in Tanzania recently, over the last 4 or 5 years, they lost 30,000 animals. In West Africa, in the forests of Equatorial Africa, they're losing dozens and dozens and dozens of elephants every month. So it is desperate. There's a vibrant market. People in China want ivory. They have no conception of what they're doing by buying ivory, and that's part of the message we want to put out.
How can they possibly have no conception of it? Everybody knows what an elephant is. They know they're magnificent. They're not ignorant in China, are they? They must know that the elephants are being killed to harvest this ivory.
Well, step back a minute and remember where China was until very recently. It was one of the poorest communist countries in the world. It's only in the last 10 or 15 years that people have joined the economic rush to the future. Now China's got a lot of buying power. At the time we destroyed ivory in 79, the Chinese went to market. They had nothing. Many Chinese think that it's like cow horns and antlers of deer. Come winter, you drop them, you use them. Natural deaths. They have no idea of the violent deaths most of these animals are suffering. And I think it's an education program, but I don't think we should necessarily think China's the problem. China and the Chinese market could be the solution if we can persuade them to kill it. And the Chinese premier, working with Barack Obama, have issued a number of very, very encouraging statements about joining hands between the United States and China to kill the international trade. And I think we must give a lot of credit to the way the Chinese leader is moving us at this time.
How many elephants remain? Is there a credible estimate of the number of remaining elephants in Africa, Dr. Leakey?
I'm not sure how credible it is, but probably 400,000, down from 1.6 million maybe 20 years ago. It's massive loss.
And what kind of organization is around the tusk and elephant killing business? Who's guiding these hunters, and who's buying and where? How does it work?
Well, Africa's a poor continent. There are a lot of people who can pay for a year's expenses by killing one elephant. There are a lot of middlemen from Somalia and from Southeast Asia who are in Kenya, and they say, we'll buy your tusks at $500 a kilo. They then bring it together and make a shipment, an illegal shipment, through very badly policed ports such as Mombasa. Countries such as Tanzania and others ship it through Kenya because we've got a lot of corruption in our ports. This is being tackled, but it's still a huge problem. Then it goes off to a central buyer in Hong Kong or in China, and it gets distributed to the carvers. The connection between the man who has a wonderful carving on his mantel shelf and the man who killed the elephant is far away. The man who killed the elephant may get $500 a kilo. The man who paid for it at the other end is getting between $3,000 and $4,000 a kilo.
Well, Dr. Richard Leakey is with us from Nairobi, Kenya, famed paleoanthropologist, conservationist. He watched as more than 100 tons of tusks were burned last weekend to try to discourage the hunting and killing of elephants for ivory, for knickknacks and jewelry and stuff on the mantelpiece. Dr. Leakey, we have callers from around the country for you, if I may. Randy in Corydon, Indiana. Randy, you're on the air with Dr. Leakey in Nairobi.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Doctor. Thank you very much for taking my call. I find the killing of these beautiful animals, you know, very intelligent. It's deplorable. We also need to keep in mind that the people who are doing this, I mean, they are, in many cases, just trying to make a living. And
yeah, you're right.
I'm concerned that if we don't give them a better alternative to make a living,
well, Randy, yeah,
and hit them with a lot of punishments, so to speak, that they may start killing off animals, you know, regardless of the type, out of revenge.
Randy, let me take that to Dr. Leakey. What about alternatives here? I mean, clearly, you're trying to lay down a marker right now, but they have an economic future to consider.
Well, I think, Randy, what I'd put to you is if we can kill the market, kill the desire for ivory, there are many other ways people can make a living, particularly if the governments of African countries recognize that we have taken away an income to a very low-level income group. I mean, they're not hundreds of poachers. They're dozens of poachers. It's the middlemen who don't need the money anyway. And I think we have to try all attempts, but I honestly believe if you can kill the market, You won't have to kill the people. You won't have to have punitive sentences. The whole trade will dry up.
How would you do it, Dr. Leakey? How do you kill the market, as you say? What specific measures or steps might be taken that would accomplish that?
Well, if we can promote the publicity that went with the fire and other events that we've had to get to the point where people are automatically ashamed to be seen with ivory. We want a society in China, a society in North America, a society in Africa. But if you're showing off with ivory, your neighbors, your friends, your family say, shame on you. How dare you do that to an endangered species? We did this with spotted cats many years ago under Brigitte Bardot. We did it for elephants in terms of the European and American market
yeah.
in 1989. We can do it again.
Patty in Spokane, Washington. Patty, you're on the air.
I went to Fiji, and there's shop after shop of ivory objects, just thousands of objects and jewelry in one shop, carved statues. They're just incredible, and they're made in India and sold by the Hindustani shop owners in Fiji, not the Fijians, because the Fijians can't own shops. It's just this crazy system that goes on in Fiji, but I was absolutely shocked, and the other tourists would just go in and buy them, no thought about it. They didn't care because they were beautiful. So I just wanted you to know that the idea of ending it by burning the tusks, the problem is so enormous.
Patty, I appreciate your call from Spokane, Washington, very much, Patty. Dr. Leakey, is it discouraging to hear of this robust trade going on in far-flung Fiji in ivory, even as you're trying so hard there in Kenya to stop it?
Well, we know about it, and this is why we're using the publicity that this burn has generated to go to the Convention for International Trade in Endangered Species in September of this year. It's taking place in September, and we believe we can get enough support from all the countries who are currently dealing in ivory to agree to a total ban on any ivory trade across international frontiers. If we can do that, and if we can police it as I believe we can, then I think what the lady saw in Fiji and in other parts of the world will gradually dry up, and the elephants could have a hopeful future.
Robert in Corning, New York. You're on with Richard Leakey, Dr. Leakey in Nairobi, Kenya.
Good day, gentlemen. Excuse me. My question is whether ivory can be harvested from living elephants so that control could be taken away from poachers. Our market is always going to exist.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's an anesthesia or some kind of a way to obtain the ivory and the elephant lives on and perhaps grows more ivory.
Got it. Dr. Leakey?
Yeah, I think the answer is, in theory, yes. Tusks are the canine teeth in elephants. They're like your own teeth, enamel and dentine. They're constantly growing, and elephants have tusks because they actually need them. They need them to get bark off trees and to feed, dig in sand rivers. And if you detusk an elephant, you'd have to go right into much more serious a surgery than even a root canal. Elephants basically need their tusks, and I don't think that's the solution. Many of these elephants live in very, very difficult places to catch and to do dentistry on, and I think it'd be far better to have stiffer penalties, but more importantly, to ban the trade and shame people into never buying ivory again.
Ban the trade, shame people into never buying ivory again. Those sound like pretty good ideas. Wilson in Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on with Dr. Leakey in Nairobi.
Hi, Tom. I don't know how to even to begin this. I am so pleased that and grateful that you have done this program, or at least you've had Dr. Richard Leakey on the program. Dr. Richard Leakey is amazing. I'm a Kenyan-American. I live in Somerville, and this is such the African elephant issue is such a big issue, so and it's so important.
Yes.
I really think what really needs to be done is you need to, if you or someone else needs to go to China and hold like a town hall type program there so that people can be educated there in China about the fact that this ivory is coming from a very beautiful animal.
Yes.
And that they need to know that it is killed in order for this ivory to reach China. And You really, because I've read in certain places that some Chinese folks don't even know that this ivory coming to China is the result of a beautiful animal being slaughtered.
Yeah.
And really, I think the real solution really is to actually go to China. And I'm not, I don't want to put you on the spot.
Because I hear it, Wilson. You're under my skin right there. I mean, Dr. Leakey has a bigger profile than I hear, but nevertheless, you're on to something there. And I really appreciate your call as a Kenyan American in particular. Dr. Leakey, what about it? Perhaps you or I or someone should stand before China and say, please.
Wilson, I appreciate Asante for your remarks. I have been to China. I've been to Hong Kong. Other people are working on it. And I think there is a new breed of Chinese coming up. I think they're watching international programs on the Facebook, web, television. I think in the next few years, 5 years perhaps, you're going to see a totally different attitude than we've seen historically. Obviously, it won't happen unless we push it. We are pushing it as best as we can, and I think a number of organizations are springing up in China with the same message. I think we can keep the elephant going long enough that if we can stop the trade, they will rebound, and we're going to have the awful but wonderful problem of having too many elephants.
That would be a marvelous, marvelous problem by comparison. Dr. Richard Leakey, joining us today from Nairobi, author of The Sixth Extinction, Patterns of Life and the Future of Humankind. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Leakey.
Thank you, too.
Stop the trade. Shame the buyer. It's encouraging to hear what's going on, but sad to contemplate the killing that still remains. Listeners, thank you for all your input today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.